the next gubernatorial race isn't till November 2018. You're aware of that, right?
Well, of course. Let me say a few things on that. First of all, Governor Cuomo, of course, is already started and quite candidly far ahead. He has raised over $16 million for his reelect, and it's in his war chest. And, you know, when you consider the I'm very much into reality-based assessments. I mean, this is natural coming from a soldier, you know, given the realities that we deal with. And so, you know, our team, we insist on a reality-based assessment. And here's what we have concluded. First of all, this state obviously is a 2-to-1 advantage for Democratic enrollment. We also make the assumption that Governor Cuomo will raise and spend in excess of $50 million in this reelect. And so when you put that together, to me, we are of the mind that our candidate needs to start early.
So you think it's going to take 2 years just to raise the money?
Absolutely, to raise the money. But, you know, of course, the money is really just intended to get your message out. And so I want to make it clear that part of the reason why we're starting early is to make the connections. That's part that we actually rolled into this set, talking about how many counties that we've been to. We are going to work really hard to get to know people and to listen and to bring a whole new leadership in Albany, one that is collaborative, one that is inspirational, one that is aspirational, and one that I believe will change the trajectory of our state. And, in, you know, those 4 points that I think what I have heard already in these over 40 counties is the economy. And, you know, Karen, all of us, we watch on TV when we have that moment, perhaps to watch TV. We see these commercials, and it's telling us that all is good in New York and that the economy is flourishing. Keep in mind, we pay for those commercials, and you got to wonder, what is that all about? How come our taxpayer dollars are being used to broadcast these commercials about our own state?
You're talking about the New York Open for Business and the tourism type ads.
Well, I am. And
I mean, you know, every governor's done that.
Oh, my goodness gracious. He's spent an enormous amount of taxpayer dollars. Let's keep in mind this, that a study came out last week. We are dead last. We are 50th out of 50 in the country when it comes to tax burden. In terms of the local and state taxes, 12.7 cents out of every dollar goes towards local and state taxes. We can't continue to do business like this. I mean, so if the governor is running these ads to up his job approval, Siena's last poll had 58% of the people did not think he was doing a good job. If the point of the commercials is to up his job approval, I've got an idea for him. Why doesn't he stop running the ads and cut taxes? Because that will actually probably achieve the effect he's trying to do, but I don't hold out much hope for that.
Well, you mentioned the polls. The governor has been pretty much stuck in the polls for nearly a year now with his job approval rating below 50%, about half the people like him. Does that show to you that he's vulnerable?
Well, indeed. When you consider it's a 2-to-1 Democratic state and the fact that his disapproval or the people who are not satisfied with his job performance was 58%, I think it shows to the wide-ranging disaffection, but it goes beyond just that. There's really an alienation in his leadership style. This is a leader who has demonized teachers. He has picked a fight and bullied the mayor of New York City. He's rode a roughshod over those that work for him, anyone who speaks to the media that work for the administration. He's been very tough on them. And so, you know, there's a feeling that this is not someone who really inspires the kind of loyalty and he demands the loyalty, but he doesn't inspire it. And I think there's a difference. And so when you couple that with these commercials, which tell us that all is good in New York, when deep down New Yorkers know that things are not going as well as they could be. So I think when you couple that together and when you have a platform that unites, and I do think that there is one that I'm hearing that is based on – I started talking about the economy. Of course, that's priority number one. I do think we need broad-based tax reduction. I mean, look, that's got to happen. You know, you look at the property taxes that people pay, very expensive. And I think of our seniors. I've talked to some seniors that are actually paying now more with their house paid off. They have no more mortgage payment, but they're actually paying more now a month in taxes than they did in their first mortgage payment when they started paying for their home.
Well, we do have a cap
on property taxes. No,
yeah, but when you – well, that's not enough. And look, you know, we're the only state in the country that passes along the Medicaid burden to counties. And when you talk to county executives – I was talking to Kathy Gimeno not long ago – 55% of the county levy, tax levy, comes from the Medicaid. And we're the only state in the nation that does this. It's not fair. It's certainly not fair to all the counties, Westchester and North. It's not fair, but it's not fair in general.
Okay, but if the state took it over, then that's a lot of money that would have to be paid somewhere, right? So wouldn't that mean that income taxes might go up?
No, I think what you have to do is we are looking into fraud, waste, and abuse in this system. You know, when you look at it nationwide, it's a major issue. We're looking for ways that we can bring efficiencies. You know, it is a significant figure. It's about $8 billion in a state that's close to $100 billion. So it's not a small number. But if it's done over a period of time, you wouldn't be able to pull this back off the counties in 1 year. But if you did it over a five-year period, and if you did that by bringing in all the stakeholders, that's the thing that Governor Cuomo doesn't do. We're going to talk about this platform that I think unites. And one figure that you're often going to hear, or one fact you're going to hear, is the governor does not bring the stakeholders together, like education. Hopefully we'll talk about that in a second. Mm-hmm. But with regard to Medicaid, I can tell you that the governor has alienated the disabilities community in some of the pace of change, whether it be rate rationalization or sheltered workshops or even the way he has rolled out the minimum wage and a number of different things. The good people that work in the disabilities community don't feel that their voices have been brought into consideration. So when you talk about delivering high-quality Medicaid services at a price that the taxpayers are proud of, that is certainly an area where we can work together. And an area where we can help the counties, because if the counties can lower their tax rates, that's going to help our hardworking businesses. It's also going to help seniors. It's going to help us all in many different directions. So the first is the economy. The second point I would say is cleaning up Albany. You know, we're rife with corruption.
We'll go to that. I was going to go to something else, but we will go to that. Well, there's some ethics proposals out there, but. You might think, surprisingly, since both leaders of the legislature were arrested and convicted last year, that they would be acting quicker to enact some kind of reform. But nothing's happened. The session is, you know, well underway.
We need leadership. We need leadership that leads by example. You know, the governor, I find this from my experiences in the military. Certainly, you know, leading men and women in combat was very stressful and very challenging. That's the reason why a leader gets out front. You know, I fought and bled for this country, and, you know, it was important to our family that we lead by example now in public life, and that's why my wife and I, we earned that pension after 29 years, but we didn't think it was right that we'd double dip. We didn't think it was right that we'd at once get a check for being a paycheck for being a member of Congress and collect another paycheck from the people for this pension. So we voluntarily give that back, and I want to use it as a contrast to say that, you know, Governor Cuomo said among the ethics proposals, he said, well, let's limit outside income for legislators. Well, that's certainly something we can talk about, right? We can look at this in great detail, analyze it, mm-hmm. decide whether or not and how to, if we decide to do it, how to do that. It's hard to take, quite candidly, from a leader who took a check for $700,000. Governor Cuomo took a check as an advance to the book that he published for $700,000. So how is it?
Well, what do you read into that? Are you saying it's because of HarperCollins and Rupert Murdoch, they need things from New York State, that there's some kind of...
No, that's not a comment at all about that. I wouldn't know anything on that score. But here's my point. The same leader who's telling others to do something won't do it himself. This is a consistent theme with Governor Cuomo. It's do as I say, not as I do. And I think because you asked the question, why are they seem to be stymied on ethics reform? We need leadership that goes first. I think what we need is a candidate that will self-impose term limits. I will do that if I'm ultimately at the end of this year, if I decide to go forward. And right now, I must tell you, there's been a lot of enthusiasm and strong support. And if that continues, we will go forward. I would then self-impose term limits. I would say two terms, 4 years each. Mm-hmm. And then I would ask the legislature to send it to me so that we could put it in law. Could it put it in statute? And then as I look at – then we're in a position to have that conversation from the legislature having gone first. Speaking of legislative reform, I want to commend the Assembly Republicans. I that spirit of 76, I think, is good reform package. You know, when you think about what we as a people expect in our government, we expect it to listen and be responsive to us. That's inherent in this spirit of 76, because if you have an assemblyman or woman anywhere in the city or upstate, and they get a good idea from their constituent, and they bring that idea to Albany, and then they can get a majority or half their people, their legislators, their colleagues to support that idea, they would at least get a hearing and a vote.
Because what you're referring to is that the Assembly Democratic leader says it has to be 76 Democrats who want something before it's on the floor.
Well, and that's my point is that this should be empowering that through regular order, if an idea garners the support of the majority of the legislature, it ought to at least get a hearing and a vote. It doesn't guarantee that it's going to pass, but there ought to be this sense of empowerment. Why is that important? Is it important for the legislators? Well, of course it is, but it's actually more broader and deeper than that. Because when you empower the legislators like this, you're empowering the people. Their ideas matter. And then also, look, if a legislator is convicted, they should not have a pension. I'm surprised that we're talking about this, but that's not done yet. And then let me also say this, that I do think that as reform packages, they're going to need to close that LLC loophole.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem is that, you know, we think that we have limits, but we really don't. Because of this LLC loophole, there's really unlimited giving, and that should stop. And then here's the final piece, and I'll certainly allow for follow-up, and that we should have independent redistricting. And that's really because, you know, oftentimes we have this illusion that we pick our representatives when too often representatives pick their voters through the reapportionment and redistricting process that happens every 10 years. So, look, I have led by example on this. I was in a Republican-leaning district, and I went to a Democratic-leaning district. And even though I was in a district that President Obama carried twice and I was outspent 2-1 in 2014, I won by just short of 30 percentage points. So you can still win even when you're in a district that's drawn that isn't necessarily at first blush favorable to you if you work with sincerity and hard work and deliver results. And here's the important piece about all of this is that it restores faith in our ability to be self-governing. So I do think we need independent redistricting.
So you mentioned the LLC loophole, you'd like to see it closed. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned earlier you need to raise an awful lot of money to compete with Governor Cuomo. Are you going to take LLC money?
Well, LLC money itself isn't the problem so much as the loophole, which allows it to be unlimited.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. If there's some group that wants to, you know, circumvent the campaign laws and give you, you know, what the numbers were, like $100,000 when they're supposed to only give $5,000. I mean, would you accept that?
So that is the problem. You've defined it, I think, properly.
I mean, are you going to play?
Well, here's what I've said. I've said this. Even though Governor Cuomo has a $16 million head start, if he self-imposes closing the LLC loophole, I will too. Even though he's $16 million ahead and has a 2-1 voter registration advantage. But what I can't do is unilaterally disarm. What I will do, though, is even give him a significant advantage, the head start he has.
So you mentioned that you're Republican, of course. It's 2-1 Democratic enrollment in the state. A lot's changed really since Governor Pataki was the last Republican who won when he won re-election. I think it was 2002, so that was like – it'll be like 16 years by 2018.
Well,
what do you have to offer Democrats? And, you know, a lot of Democrats in New York City that would come out and vote in this election.
Well, you're absolutely right on that, that it is challenging. The path to the top is very steep and narrow. And indeed, as you point out, it's actually 400,000 votes harder than 1994. People will bring up, well, you know, Pataki did it in 1994, but the Democratic to Republican enrollment advantage is actually 400,000 more now in 2016. So, you know, but I will tell you this, that this platform I'm beginning to lay out, we've talked about growing the economy. We've talked about cleaning up Albany and restoring faith in our ability to be self-governing. The third point is education, that we need a whole new direction on this. The governor has demonized teachers. He has foisted down all our throats, the Common Core. This implementation as well has been horrendous. And he has disaffected so many people, not just teachers. I've never seen teacher morale so flagging, which is very concerning to me. I think teachers are special. I mean, they already know they're not going to be rich getting in, but they get to be rich at heart by inspiring, inculcating, and, yes, educating. And what we need to do is support them, but also parents, very upset with Common Core, administrators as well. So, you know, I think we're on our third reboot now of Common Core. And I can tell you that out there, as I listen, there's not a lot of confidence he's going to get it right. He's saying he's learned, but people are watching him very closely.
Well, he's throwing it back on the State Education Department, the Regents now. And they are making some efforts, and we're going to see a big change in the Regents Board. Do you think that's a hopeful sign, or do you think that people that you're talking to are still feel very disaffected about
it? Well, they're confused. And quite candidly, their expectations are not especially high. They've come to not trust this governor. So I can tell you this much, everyone's going to be watching for actions, deeds, not words. So, you know, I think it's not that complicated, actually. What I think we ought to do is roll back the Common Core. We ought to go back to the New York State standards. We should then bring together all the stakeholders. This is, again, the same kind of combo with Medicaid, is that we need to include the professionals who have a stake in this every day, just as I would as a brigade commander, by the way. I would do that with my non-commissioned officers and my paratroopers, would include them in the planning process because I knew that they were going to be the ones out front executing the policy. And, you know, with regard to education, we need to do this. We need to hear from our teachers. They need to have a substantive input in this. Same with parents. The same with administrators. And so I will tell you this. Here's what I learned, Karen, is that when you, instead of using a centralization approach one that relies on unfunded mandates and onerous high-stakes testing, if you use instead an approach of mentorship, professional development, you get more positive results. We did this in the military. We spent a lot of time in leader development, junior leader development, and that meant instruction, that meant application, exercise, that meant feedback on the exercise from the mentor, and then the opportunity to do it again. And that what we found over time is that iterative commitment is that the leaders became more competent and confident, and that translated into organizational effectiveness. So I think if we use that approach, it's a tragic irony that at a time that Governor Cuomo was demonizing teachers, he was cutting the budget for professional development. He was completely upside down. We need a whole new direction in education. And then also, let me say this, that you mentioned the city.
Yeah.
So I was in Harlem a couple days ago, and I was meeting with local leaders, and they feel less secure today. There are issues with security, safety and security in New York City. And, you know, my point to you is that every time that this comes up, Governor Cuomo keeps saying we need more gun control. And, you know, my point to the folks I met in New York City is how's that working out? Well, it's not working out. And of course it doesn't work out because with gun control, you're targeting law-abiding citizens. And so what I would tell you this much is that if you look at a contrast between Governor Cuomo and myself, I've spent 29 years in safe and secure. I'm very aware of the challenges. And I would tell you that I can deliver more safety and security for New York City than Governor Cuomo can. And I can do it in a manner that actually unites the state, that, you know, by supporting mental health, by cracking down on gangs and narco traffickers, by helping law enforcement, by supporting them and helping them get to better know their communities and support their communities. These efforts, and by the way, I mentioned I was in Utica last night. There's an initiative there, like a midnight basketball type of initiative that helps bring community solidarity. These approaches are better than targeting law-abiding citizens. So, you know, I think that we can put in place a set of policies that will actually deliver more safe and secure for the city and allow us to roll back the SAFE Act. So in that way, you're actually uniting the state.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is parts of the SAFE Act that people, law-abiding gun owners, have been annoyed about, correct?
But absolutely, and it hasn't worked. I mean, when I mentioned this meeting in Harlem, the lady that I was talking to had just come from a funeral where a young man had been shot in the streets. And, you know, the point is that the SAFE Act didn't help in that regard. What we have to do is look at the sources of insecurity, and we need thoughtful, cogent policies that actually address the sources of insecurity. And when we actually bring forward that, then we can roll back the policies that weren't making us safer, and we're really dividing the state. So what I would tell you is that this four-point platform, which is on growing the economy, it's on restoring faith in Albany and cleaning up the corruption, on a new direction in education, and delivering on safe and secure, I think that that's a platform that will attract. It will certainly get the Republican conservative base out, but it will win a majority of independents, and it will also attract a fair amount of disaffected Democrats who are looking for a whole new direction in the state and new leadership.
Okay, because we're into 20 minutes, and not all of this is going to get on the air. I have other questions, but I want to just go to some hot button and social issues, because mm-hmm. I don't know where you stand mm-hmm. on any of them, honestly. Abortion rights, mm-hmm. just, you know, quickly.
Well, I think it's a settled issue. And oftentimes what the governor will do and, you know, perhaps others, is they'll try to go in that direction because they're trying to distract the electorate. It's a settled issue. You know, it's not – I mean
– You mean because of Roe v. Wade and you don't see that being overturned?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so, look, what really are the issues that I'm hearing across the 40-plus counties in the state are about the economy. It's about faith in government, cleaning up the corruption. It's about education, a whole new direction in education that's towards empowerment, not towards centralization and demonizing teachers.
But I guess when you say it's a settled issue, you say you wouldn't – tamper with the rights that
right.
women have.
Well, that's right, because it's already been settled. Okay. And so I don't think that that's not among the issues that I'm hearing from mm-hmm. folks of the kind of leadership and the direction that they want the
okay.
state to go
gay
in.
Gay marriage, where do you stand on that?
That's a settled issue as well.
Mm-hmm. You think the state
absolutely.
Has
it's,
it? Absolutely.
It's a settled issue.
You don't need to revisit it. What about climate change? What do you think is causing climate change?
Well, I think it's real. You know, I'm in Columbia County. We're sitting here today in Kinderhook. And thank you for coming, by the way.
Yeah, and where's the snow?
Yeah. Well, you know, we also have four new invasive species in the last decade here in Columbia County. This has absolutely got the attention of my farmers, some of whom are very conservative Republicans. It's undeniable. I mean, we're dealing with rising sea levels, which has impact. You know, I mentioned these invasive species. I mean, candidly, we've been visited by some really violent storms. Hurricanes Irene, Lee, and Sandy, all within, you know, 3 years. These were 500-year floods. So either you believe that this was a 1 in 10 million chance, or you believe, as I do, that this is a new normal. So, you know, I have sponsored a resolution in the Congress that recognizes the reality of the changing climate and that humans are contributing to it. How much? We don't know. We have humility about it, but we know that humans are contributing. And what we need is more research on this so we can better understand how we're impacting. And we need to change our habits. I have the strongest record in the House of Representatives when it comes to clean energy. Big proponent for all the right reasons. It's not only good for the environment, but it's also good for the economy. It's good for our local economy. It's good for our foreign policy. You know, we've been too dependent on energy sources overseas, and that's impacted us. So I'm very aggressive in trying to get my party to change. This resolution, I'm proud to say, does have 13 Republicans standing with me on this, but we are now in the throes of inviting 13 Democrats to come with us. And our intent is for the 26 of us is to introduce a new piece of legislation in the next month or so that actually makes it easier for public-private partnerships to proliferate clean energy and energy efficiencies.
Okay, last question. Who are you supporting for president?
Well, I'm uncommitted and quite frankly, underwhelmed. You know, as somebody who grew up in a working class family in the 1970s, my family, Irish Catholic, they were all Democrats from the time that they came over on the boat. And I was the first Republican ever, in part because of what I lived through as a teenager. I watched my dad. My dad was a mechanic in the building trades. He worked for Otis Elevator. And, you know, when he was working, life was good. We had a living wage. We had benefits. But dad was laid off quite a bit in the late 70s. And so, you know, I had this experience where I would go to school during the day. I would read about our history, incredible history, and just remarkable in terms of the promise of American life. And then I would come home, and I'd see my dad out of work. He wasn't in a very good mood, honestly, but then I would turn the TV on and I'd watch our president at the time, Jimmy Carter. He seemed like a very moral man. And, you know, he's talking in terms of, you know, turning our temperature, our thermostat down and wearing sweaters and which, you know, I get it. I love sweaters too. I'm from upstate New York. But here's the point. The perception I would get is that, you know, our best days were behind us. And so I had this sort of cognitive dissonance between reading in the morning in the afternoon the history of the country and then what I witnessed at home and then on TV. So I was in the space to be influenced by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
You know, I know that there may be listeners out there who don't agree with me on this, and I certainly respect that. But I'm just trying to give you a sense of what impacted me as a 15 and 16-year-old, that this was somebody who I thought always seemed to be positive. He was in a good mood. He had a vision for economic vitality that even included my working class family. He had a vision of peace through strength, which I thought was really important as well. It so inspired me. I actually enlisted as a private E1 in the infantry as a 17-year-old. I was still a junior in high school. So, you know, why am I bringing that all up? Because I was inspired.
Yeah.
It was an aspirational campaign. I'm not seeing that this year.
Yeah,
I don't see any of the candidates. You know, campaigns are about emotions. I certainly understand
that. They seem to be channeling a lot of public anger.
Well, give them that
on both sides.
Well, this is on both sides. But see, you know, campaigns are about emotions. And so too often, unfortunately, it's about anger and fear. But it doesn't have to be. It can also be about elevating. It can be aspirational. I want to see that. And then also I will tell you that I want to see more evidence that the candidates are studying because, you know, when I first came home from the Army, I knew that, you know, running for Congress, that I would be representing farmers. And look, I mean, there's not a dairy product I don't love. I love them all. But, I mean, I didn't know a lot about farming. I had to really go to school. I went to what I called dairy boot camp. Mm-hmm. You know, where I went and I milked cows and I cleaned up after them and I mixed the feed and I learned the books. Yeah, I mean, I got up every morning in the Army at 5 to get for boot camp and dairy. It was 3 o'clock wake up call. So, you know, but here's the point. I had to humble myself. I had so much to learn and I still do. I learn every day. And when I look at these issues, these complex issues that these candidates are dealing with, and I look at national security and foreign affairs, and I see candidates who, you know, don't know the difference between the F-22 and the F-35 and the difference between the Quds Force and the Kurds. That worries me. I don't expect them to know everything about these matters, but I do want to see a commitment to learning, to getting better over time, and I want to see a more serious engagement on that. So I'm uncommitted.
So you haven't – actually, I forgot. There is actually one last question I have. There is a president that came from Kinderhook, Martin Van Buren. Do you think he's going to be the only president that comes from Kinderhook in our history?
My goodness. Looking into a crystal ball, that's not anything I'm good at. So what I will tell you this is that we're proud of Martin Van Buren here, and certainly eyes are wide open here, reality-based assessment. Not that everything in his administration was rosy, but the fact is that Martin Van Buren grew up here. He had a work ethic. He believed in people. He stood up for working class people and for farmers. And, you know, he rose to high responsibility. And, you know, he's a favorite son here in Kinderhook. And I think that when you look across
the – Do you see any parallels with yourself
there? No, I would not do that. But I would say this. I think that figures like Martin Van Buren all throughout America – remind us of the possibility of American life. And I think it's really important that every American feel that they have that possibility. Certainly in the Army, you know, there was only one color in the Army. It was green. We all wore Army green, and we all stood for the values of this country. And so when you think about the promise of American life, and you think about Martin Van Buren and others, what we can all work together, I think, is to strengthen that American dream going forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving me all this time.
Thank you, Karen. Best wishes.